Osho, The Dhammapada, The Way of the Buddha, Volume 12, Discourse Number 9.
Bhagwan, possessing nothing, wanting nothing, he is full of power, fearless, wise, exalted. He has vanquished all things. He sees by virtue of his purity. He has come to the end of the way, over the river of his many lives, his many deaths. Beyond the sorrow of hell, beyond the great joy of heaven, by virtue of his purity. He has come to the end of the way. All that he had to do, he has done. And now, he's one.
These are the last golden sutras of Dhammapada. Possessing nothing, wanting nothing, he is full of power. Why man wants to possess? It is one of the most fundamental things to be understood. Unless you understand why there is a constant hankering to possess more and more things, money, power, you will not be able to get rid of this insanity of possessiveness. Man wants to possess because he has not known who he is. He is unaware of his inner kingdom. He thinks he is a beggar. Hence he begs. Desires are beggars. The more you desire, the more you prove that you are unaware of your own treasures. That very unawareness leads you into the desert of possessiveness. It is a desert because you will not attain to anything. You may possess the whole world, still you will remain the same hollow person, empty, your life meaningless, your vision clouded, your heart dead, your soul unborn. Man wants to possess because he feels tacitly that something is missing. What exactly is missing, he is not able to decipher. But something is missing, that much is felt by everybody. so rus and fill the gap. Naturally we start imitating others. Children are imitators. The only way they learn things is by imitating their parents and by the people who surround them. They are all running after money, after power, prestige, respectability. Naturally, the child thinks these are the things that have to be attained, achieved, whatsoever the cost. I have to risk all. And life is short. Hence, I have to put my energies in a concentrated way. I have to move into one particular direction with my totality. I have to be money mad if I really want to possess money, because I am not the alone who is running after it. Millions of people are running after it. It is going to be a great struggle. And only those who are cunning, clever, crafty are going to win the race. So be cunning, be crafty. But anyhow, you have to win the race. You have to prove yourself that you are somebody, that your life was not in vain. The child learns all this in a very unconscious way from the atmosphere in which he is born. And whatsoever the society may be, the game is the same. Somewhere it is the money that is more important. If you are born in America, the money is more important. That brings power. If you are born in Soviet Russia, then money is not so important. Then political power is real money, real gold. You have to be high in the hierarchy of the Communist Party. But the game is the same. If you are born in a so-called religious country like India, then you have to become a great saint. You have to defeat all the other saints. It is the same game now played in the name of religion. You have to be the greatest ascetic, the most famous. You have to leave everybody far behind. Look deep down. It is a single game being played in so-called religious countries, capitalist countries, communist countries, whatsoever the format, the structure. But the game is the same. The game is the game of the ego. And we are tremendously interested in fulfilling our ego. but it cannot be fulfilled. It is impossible to fulfill it. Because in the first place, the ego is a non-entity. It is not real. It is fictitious. If you have a real hunger, there is a way to satisfy it. But if your hunger is unreal, there is no way to satisfy it. If you have a real disease, it can be cured. But if you are a hypochondriac and you invent diseases which exist nowhere, nobody can cure you. It is impossible to cure you. There is nothing to cure. And if somehow you are convinced that one disease has been cured, you have the same old mind, it will invent another disease. It will go on inventing. Ego is your invention. The hunger of the ego is your invention. You have to keep yourself occupied because you feel in a state of embarrassment. You are not even aware who you are. How you can be at ease? You feel a deep unease. It is always there. To hide it, you keep yourself occupied with the money, with power, with religion, with politics. These are all escapes. You can find any escape. There are many alternatives available. But you keep yourself occupied, so there is no need to become so conscious of your inner trembling. Whenever you have time, whenever you are unoccupied, suddenly the inner hollowness starts opening up. And you become afraid. It is like an abyss. You are afraid. You may slip into it. Hang onto something. Invent something if there is nothing else to hang to. That's why people are ready even to cling to their misery. Nobody is easily ready to drop his misery. That's my experience of working with thousands of people. All their problems can be reduced to one problem, that they cling to their misery. It is very difficult for them to drop their miseries, because their miseries are keeping them occupied. Their miseries are helping them to avoid themselves, and their inner hollowness, emptiness, meaninglessness, their miseries are nothing but a way of escape. Of course, those miseries are hurting. Hence they talk about how to get rid of them. But they cannot drop them, because dropping them means they will be left empty. So they are in a double bind. They want not to be miserable, and yet they cannot drop their miseries. Miseries are not clinging to you, remember. You are clinging to your miseries. You can drop your miseries only when some inner meaning starts flowering in you. Miseries can be dropped only when meditation starts blooming in you. Because then you start enjoying your emptiness. It is no more empty. Emptiness itself starts having a positive fragrance. It is no more negative. That's the whole magic of meditation. It transforms your emptiness into a positive fulfillment, into something overwhelming. Emptiness becomes silence. Emptiness becomes peace. And emptiness becomes divine. It becomes godliness. There is no greater magic than meditation. To transform the negative into positive, to transform darkness into light, that is the miracle of meditation. To transform a trembling person into a fearless soul. To transform a person who was clinging to every stupid thing into a non-clinger, into a non-possessor. That is what happens through meditation. Buddha used to call meditation a great sword. It cuts your problems from the very root. It makes you aware that you need not be afraid of your inner abyss. It is beautiful. It is blissful. You have not experienced its bliss and beauty because you have never gone into it. You have always been escaping. You have never tasted of it. It is nectar. It is not poison. But how you are going to know without tasting it? You are running away from something which can become your life's fulfillment. You are running away from something which is the only thing worth achieving. You are running from yourself. Possessing nothing, wanting nothing. Buddha says, that's where meditation brings the master. He is no more interested in possessing, and he is no more desiring anything. All desires have left him. Because he has found the ultimate, beyond which there is nothing else. He has found the inexhaustible treasure of joy, of bliss, of ecstasy. What else he can desire? He has found a mine of diamonds. Now he cannot go on collecting colored stones and seashells on the sea beach. Now that whole activity is stupid. Not that he renounces it. That is one of the most significant thing to be remembered. The real sannyasin never renounces anything. He simply understands his own inner world, its beauty, its benediction, its blissfulness, and understanding it, great renunciation happens on its own accord. All that is futile slips out of his hands. He cannot cling to it anymore. He becomes non-possessive. Nothing is anymore so important to cling to. Everything becomes of this world just a toy to play with. Good for those who are not yet grown up. But a meditator has become adult. Only a meditator becomes adult. Otherwise, your chronological age may be 70, 80 or 90. It does not matter. You are only an old child. 90-year-old, but still immature, because still interested in the toys, still carrying your teddy bears, still interested in purchasing more and more toys. Children can be forgiven, but you cannot be forgiven. Only a meditator comes of age. For the first time, he becomes mature, grown up. All childishness disappears from him. And the beauty is, when all childishness disappears from you, you again become childlike, but on a different plane. No childishness, but absolutely childlike. The same purity, the same innocence, the same wonder, the same awe. Again, existence becomes a mystery. But not that you are childless. You are childlike. It is a totally different phenomenon. Childishness is immaturity. To have a childlike purity is maturity. They are polar opposites. Possessing nothing, wanting nothing, the master is at home. He is no more running after shadows. He is not running at all. Just now, to say to you that you are also Buddhas, will look absurd. To you at least it will look absurd. You will listen. You love me. And you will try to understand what I am saying. But deep down, you will not be convinced that you are Buddhas. That's why we have been finding every possible rationalization to prove to ourselves that Buddhas are a totally different race. Every country has tried to prove to its own heart's content that Buddha belongs to some other plane of existence. Christ belongs to some other plane of existence. They are amongst us, but they are totally different from us. They are strangers. They are outsiders. Whatsoever they say is true, but it is not applicable to us. It has no relevance to our world. We live in an ordinary world, and they come from some extraordinary existence, from the beyond. Every country, every race has convinced itself that Moses, Krishna, Lao Tzu, Buddha, Jesus, Muhammad, these are not ordinary people. In some way or other, we have been trying to prove that they are extraordinary. Not that we are much interested in their being extraordinary. We are simply interested in one thing. If they are extraordinary, then we need not be worried. Then we can go on the way we are going. We need not change. We can simply remain the same as we are. To avoid a radical change, we create these great rationalizations. I say unto you that they all are as ordinary as you are as extraordinary as you are. No difference at all. Just only a very small difference, which is not a difference really. You are asleep and they are awake. You can be awakened. You can wake up. Unless you decide not to wake up. But right now, it is difficult to understand you that you are Buddhas. The function of the master is to remind you that you may be believing that you are slaves, but you are not. That is only your belief. You are masters. The function of the master is to remind you, to go on reminding you again and again that you are Buddhas. If you are behaving like fools, that is your choice. You have the freedom to behave like fools, but you have also the freedom to transform your being totally, to become as centered as a Buddha. Looking at you, it will be difficult to believe. Looking at your life, it will be difficult for yourself to believe that you can ever be mature, that you can ever be a master, that you can ever say about yourself possessing nothing, wanting nothing. You are always wanting. People are so ridiculous that if they become convinced of wanting nothing, then they start wanting this stage of wanting nothing. But it is the same game. Now the desire has come from the back door. I have heard, after Beethoven finished his joyous fourth symphony, he went through a dry period. Inspiration left him. His imagination went blank, and he could compose no new music. This was too much for his restless energy, and he fell to drinking at the local taverns, where he often wound up in bar fights or went off with horse. One night, after losing a bar fight and being rejected by the cheapest whore in town, Beethoven sat spending his last pennies on cheap wine. As he was the last customer in the empty tavern, the bartender came over to him and said, "Hey buddy, you are always causing trouble around here. What do you do for a living anyway?" Beethoven looked up, his face bruised, his lip bleeding, and said through clenched teeth, "I am a composer." The bartender said, "You? A composer? Ha 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 ha." That's how the Fifth Symphony was born. Looking at you, it is very difficult to believe that you are Buddhas. Bruised face, bleeding lips. Even rejected by the cheapest whore. Drinking cheap wine. Who will believe that you are a Buddha? But I believe. And not only I believe, I know. Just something is needed to trigger it. Just something is needed to wake you up. Beethoven went home. And again, the inspiration was back. Again, the sources were flowing. The master cannot do anything directly, but he can push you, pull you. In indirect ways, to help you to see the point. Once seen, it becomes yours. And unless it becomes yours, it is of no use. It is of no meaning. It has no validity. You are so unaware of yourself, that's why you are running after money, power, prestige. Become a little more aware of who are you. Give a little more attention to yourself. Lukovsky went to the bank to cash a check. Since Lukovsky had no account at the bank, the clerk asked if he could identify himself. "Say," asked Lukovsky, "is there a mirror around here?" "Yes," said the teller, "on the post beside you." Lukovsky glanced in the mirror and heaved a sigh of relief. "Eh," he said, "it is me, all right." That is how you recognize yourself. Always looking in the mirror. The mirrors differ. You look in the eyes of other people if they think you are a good man. You think you are a good man. If they think you are beautiful, you think you are beautiful. If they think you are intelligent, you think you are intelligent. All that you know about yourself is collected from others. Others who don't know even themselves. This is a very strange world. You are asking people, "Who are you?" And they don't know themselves. And you depend what they say about you. You depend on it. You go on collecting information. That's why it hurts when somebody says you are a fool. Why it hurts? Let him say that you are a fool. Just by his saying, you don't become a fool. But why it hurts then? It hurts because all that you know about yourself depends on public opinion. Now, that opinion comes from the same source, from the outside, from where you have been collecting the opinion that you are very intelligent. Now you are in a contradiction, that's why you are upset, disturbed. Now he has created a contradiction. No, he has created trouble for you. He has created a dilemma. Now you are again confused. You don't know who you are. A Sufi parable. A Sufi stage in a caravanserai, but there was no empty room available. So the manager said, "You will have to share the room with somebody else." The Sufi said, "That is going to create trouble. Because when I am alone in my room, in the morning when I wake up, I know perfectly well it is me. But when there are two persons in the morning, how am I going to decide who is who?" While this strange conversation was going on, the man with whom the Sufi was to share the room was also listening the whole thing. He had a great idea. The manager said, "That seems to be a relevant thing." Because the manager had come across these mad Sufis many times. They are always talking strange things. Now what a thing he is talking about. But the Sufi was saying something really significant. How do you know in the morning who is who? When there are two persons and there has been a gap of the whole night sleep, how to gather again that I am myself? The manager said, I have come across many Sufis and slowly, slowly I have learned many things about them. You do one thing. You take this rope with you, and when you go to sleep, tie this rope around your feet. So when in the morning you see the rope around your feet, you will know it is you. The Sufi said, that seems to be sensible. In the night, in the middle of the night, when the Sufi was snoring, the other men took away the rope just to play mischief, tied the rope around his own feet and went to sleep. And in the morning there was havoc. The Sufi woke up. The other man was still sleeping. He shook him and he said, now you, I know you are the Sufi, but then who am I? I am perfectly certain you are the Sufi, the rope is there. But the problem is now, who am I? And I had told this foolish manager that some trouble is bound to arise. Now this trouble has arisen. This Sufi parable is significant. It is about you. That's how you know who you are. Yes, not so visibly, but invisibly. How you recognize yourself in the mirror, are in the mirror of other people's eyes, in the mirror of their opinions. Only a Buddha is unaffected by others' opinions, because he really knows who he is. He needs no arbitrary method, no ropes, no mirrors, no information from anybody else. He knows himself directly. He has an intuitive feel about his own being. But you don't have any intuitive feel about your own being. You say you are a Christian. This is a rope your parents has put around your neck. Not even around your feet, around your neck. And you are dying because you go on becoming bigger. And the rope was tied when you were a small child. It is becoming tighter every day. Few people are dying as Christians, few as Hindus, few as Mohammedans. And everybody has a rope around his neck. How do you know you are a Christian? You never encountered Christ. If you were not told that you are a Christian, there is no possibility that you would have ever loved Christ or ever thought about him. No Jaina ever thinks about Christ. No Jew ever bothers about Christ. Although Christ was born a Jew, lived as a Jew, died as a Jew. But it is the same. No Christian ever bothers about Mahavira. Who cares about Mahavira? Even if you come across a statue of Mahavira, you may look at it as a beautiful piece of art. An antique. Or you may be a little puzzled why this man is standing naked. In one of the hotels of Bombay, just few days before the hotel opened, the hotel belongs to a Jaina family. So they had placed a statue of Mahavira, naked, a marble statue, beautiful statue, in the compound of the hotel, in a beautiful spot, surrounded by plants and fountains. And it became immediately a great attraction for the tourists. And the Jaina family was very much happy that we are spreading the message of Mahavira. But the tourists were not interested in Mahavira or in his message. They were only interested in his nakedness. They were taking photographs. The manager asked, why you are so much interested in this statue? Are you interested in Jaina philosophy? They said, what Jaina philosophy? We don't know anything about Jaina philosophy. We don't know even who this man is. All that we know is that he is standing naked and we are interested in nudity. Once this was known, the Jaina community was very much against that. This is insulting to Mahavira. Remove the statue from there. First they were very happy. Now they are against. Now they know perfectly well why people are taking photographs and why tourists are coming to the statue. For the simple reason that it is a naked beautiful statue. And Mahavira has a beautiful body. In fact, only a man like Mahavira, who has such a beautiful body, should be allowed to be naked. Nobody else. That should be a condition. I have seen many Jaina monks. They are so disgusting. They should be forced to wear clothes. Because to look at them is nauseating. They are eyesores. No Christian is interested in Mahavira. No Jaina is interested in Christ. No Mohammedan is interested in Buddha. No Buddhist is interested in Muhammad. You are interested only in the rope that has been tied around your neck when you were a child. You are still carrying it. It has become your identity. Who who are you? If you write down, then you will write your name, which has been given by others. You were born without a name. And you will write your degrees, which has been conferred by others. You were born without any degrees. If you write down the whole description about yourself, you will be surprised. There is nothing that depends on your own experience. All is dependent on others. This is not self-knowledge. This is self-deception. Unless you drop this whole deception and start from ABC to discovering yourself, you will never be able to know this beautiful experience of possessing nothing, wanting nothing. This continuous wanting of something is simply to stuff your inner emptiness. And this constant hankering to be on top is nothing but a projection of a deep feeling of inferiority complex. All the politicians suffer from inferiority complex. All the Alexanders and the Napoleons and the Hitlers and the Stalins, without any exception, they suffer from deep inferiority complex. Somewhere deep down, they know that they are nothing. They have to cover this nothingness with something beautiful. They know they are like a wound. They have to cover the wound with beautiful flowers. A politician was very much in love with his dog. One day he went to the market to buy some dog biscuits. He entered a shop and shouted, "Have you got biscuits for dogs?" The shopkeeper calmly replied, "You want to eat them here or do you want to take them home?" The politicians fight like dogs. They are dogs. And they have to be, because it is a very difficult struggle that they have to go through. They have to be very stubborn and stupid. Doggedly stupid. And doggedly stubborn. Only then there is a possibility that someday they may reach to the top. Of course, there they will not find anything. But they will go on smiling, because now it is meaningless to say that I have not found anything here. People will laugh. People will say, "We knew it from the very beginning, there is nothing." That's how people are. They always say, "We knew it from the very beginning. We had told it before that you are a fool trying to climb an empty ladder At the last rung, you will not find anything. So one who has reached to the last rung has to go on smiling as if he has achieved something. Just not to show his idiocy, that he has been an idiot, that he has wasted his whole life. There is no need to struggle really. Life is spacious enough. If we drop these foolish ideas of hierarchy, that who is on the top, and who is the first, and who is the president, and who is the prime minister, if we drop these stupid ideas of hierarchy, if we simply start living whatsoever we are, wherever we are, life can be infinitely rich because the whole energy available can transform this earth into a paradise. Noah was closing the gate of the ark, ready to leave, when the elephant appeared on the horizon, running like mad. "Come on," encouraged Noah, "faster." The elephant walked the last few steps into the ark. At that moment, the mosquito, who also was late, rushed in, stumbling upon the elephant's sting. The elephant turned back in anger and said, "Don't push. Please, there is plenty of room for everybody." Even elephants understand it, that there is plenty of room for everybody. And just a mosquito, there is enough room for you if there is enough room for the elephant. Don't push. But these political mosquitoes, they go on pushing like mad. Their whole life depends on pushing. Go on pushing till you reach the end, and then there is nothing. There has never been anything. But we are brought up, educated, conditioned to be ambitious, to be egoists. Yes, people drop desiring and wanting only when they are almost on their deathbed. But then it is too late. The old idea of sannyas was that you should become a sannyasin after 75 years. Buddha changed it. He brought a revolution into the very concept of sannyas. Hence India has never been able to forgive him. Not even yet. India has not forgiven him. Although he was born in India, he was the best flowering of Indian genius. No other person can be compared to him in the whole history of the Indian subcontinent. He is the brightest star. But India rejected him. There were many reasons to reject him. One of the most important was that he destroyed the old idea of sannyas. The old idea of sannyas was, when you are too old to live, when life is itself slipping out of your fingers, then renounce. Buddha said, "What is the point of renouncing then? Life is renouncing you." Now why you are trying to deceive yourself? You deceived yourself your whole life. Ultimately also you want to deceive you. Buddha said, if you want to renounce life, renounce when desires are very young, when possessiveness is very strong, when your whole being is ambitious. That is the moment. If you cannot do it then, you have missed one life. Mrs. Silver and Mrs. Gold were gossiping over the back fence as they hung out the vase. My husband, such a faithful man, boasted Mrs. Silver. He never even looks at another woman. The same with my husband, said Mrs. Gold. He never chases after women either. He is too fine, too decent, too old. Buddha says, possessing nothing, wanting nothing, he is full of power. When you try to possess, your power becomes invested into meaningless things. When you desire, your power becomes desires. And desires are infinite. Each desire becomes a leakage of your power. When all possessiveness and all desires have been understood as futile and dropped, you become a reservoir of power. And to be a reservoir of power is the only experience that gives you the feeling that God is. Because God is power. When you also experience power within yourself, overflowing, abundant power, you know God is. If you are empty, with no power, tired, wasted in your desires, no proof can help that God exists. All those proofs are for important people. The real person needs no proof for God. He comes to know God from the experience of inner power, from his own inner glow. Fearless, wise, exalted. He has vanquished all things. He sees by virtue of his purity. And when you are full of power, death disappears. Death appears only because you are so powerless. Death appears only because your desires are exploiting your power. They are sucking your power. Desires are suckers, parasites. They leave you empty. When you are overflowing with energy, there is no death. That experience of overflowing power makes you absolutely certain, without any doubt, that you cannot die. The body will go, the mind will go, but this power that you have felt is going to remain. It is going to expand There is no way to destroy it. If you yourself don't waste it into desires, death cannot take it away from you. And when there is no death, there is no fear. All fear is death-oriented. All fear is the shadow of death. And when you don't possess anything, you are fearless. When you don't desire, you are fearless. Nobody can take anything away from you. You don't possess. Nobody can hinder you because you don't have any desire. Nobody can obstruct your path. Nobody is your enemy. The whole existence suddenly becomes friendly. And when there is power, fearlessness, wisdom arises. Wisdom means your capacity to see the truth. You become a seer. Not that you know Quran, Gita, or Bible, but that now you know the inner scripture of consciousness itself. You know the inner Christ. You know the inner Krishna. You know that as Muhammad was receiving messages from God, you are also receiving messages from God. You are no less than any Muhammad. You are also a prophet and a messenger. You are also a Messiah. When you are full of power, you become receptive. God can connect with you only when you have power. Right now you are powerless. There is no possibility of any communion between you and God. Only power can be connected with power. Powerlessness cannot be connected with power. Only the same can meet the same. You have to be something of the divine in your own right. Then only you earn, you deserve that God should communicate with you. He becomes wise, exalted. Exalted by existence itself. The society may not respect you. The society may condemn you. The society may crucify you. But who cares about the society? The society is man-made. Existence itself exalts the man of wisdom. The man who has known himself. The man who has experienced God. The man who can say authoritatively that I know God. Not through the scriptures, but through my own experience. Existence exalts him. It is said when Buddha became enlightened, trees bloomed out of season. When Mahavira became enlightened, gods descended from the heaven and showered flowers on him. These are just metaphors, remember, not historical facts. But they indicate something. Whenever a man becomes a Buddha, whenever a man becomes enlightened, the whole existence exalts him. The whole existence bows down to him. He has come home. The whole existence welcomes him. And why the whole existence exalts him? Because existence itself is exalted through him. One of the members has reached to the ultimate peak of awakening. Through him, the whole existence has moved a little ahead into evolution. Just cancel a dozen names from the history of humanity. Lao Tzu, Moses, Abraham, Krishna, Buddha, Mahavira, Christ, Kabir, Nanak, just a dozen names. Cancel them. And where will be mankind? You would all have been Reverend Bananas. Our Reverend Tomatoes. Reverend Potatoes. But not human beings at all. You may know, you may not know. You may be aware, you may not be aware. But these few people have contributed immensely to the growth of human consciousness. Without a Buddha and a Mahavira and a Krishna and a Christ, humanity will be still hanging in the trees. Just like American tourists. They had come few days before and they were making much noise on the roof. You know them as monkeys. But you could not see them because they were on the roof. I can see through the roof. I immediately recognize these are American tourists on their way to Goa, just paying their homage for a moment here and then gone. You all would have been American tourists. These few people have released so much consciousness into the world. With each Buddha, with each person becoming enlightened, humanity goes a little ahead, a step ahead. Hence the whole universe exalts him. He has vanquished all things. Buddha means by all things the world of the mind. Not that he has vanquished all the things which are really there. You don't live in the reality. You live in your projections. The water is absolutely divine this morning. Enthused the pretty lass as he came out on the beach. It is full of men. It is your projection. You live in a world of your own ideas. My wife deserted me, mourned the unhappy husband. She took the car and ran off with a traveling salesman. Why? That is terrible, exclaimed his friend aghast. Your brand new car? Everybody lives in his own world of ideas. Buddha says he has vanquished all things. Now there is no world of ideas. He has vanquished the mind. Once the mind disappears, you can see things as they are in reality. Otherwise, you never see them as they are. You see them according to your ideas. You always look through your own projections. Those projections are subtle, but they color everything. You always look through your own prejudices. Those prejudices are so close to you that you are not aware that they are there. It is like on the glasses of your window a layer of dust has gathered. I have heard one old woman was looking out of the window, and she said to the small boy playing by the side, must have been her grandson, Bobby, today the morning seems to be very cloudy. And the boy said, Grandma, the day is perfectly as it is always. There are no clouds. Just on our window, much dust has gathered. But the old woman is not aware, may not be able to see. Her eyes are weakening. She is not able to see that the glasses are dusty. Hence she thinks the morning is cloudy. Your glasses are dusty. But when they are so close to your eyes, you become unaware of them. They are colors. Hence, the whole world looks colors. Buddha says, when you are full of powers and all desires and all pajisuness has disappeared from you, that means your mind has died, ceased to exist. Now you can see things as they are. He sees by virtue of his purity. Now everything is pure. He does not see through any screen. He sees through purity. Now he regains the wonder of childhood again. The same awe, the same mystery. He has come to the end of the way. Over the river of his many lives, his many deaths. And this is the end. When the mind ends, the journey ends. Now there will be no more any birth and no more any death. You have been born millions of times, and you have died millions of times. What you have been doing all this time, all along, Nothing, in fact. Just playing with the same games again and again, and forgetting again the lessons. It seems man never learns a thing. Each time he dies, he forgets all the lessons of that life. Next time, next birth, and he starts from ABC again. It happens. A great king asked to be initiated by a Buddha and became a bhikkhu, became his sannyasin. But because he was just a junior sannyasin, there were elders who had meditated for 30 years, 40 years. So where Buddha was staying, in a caravansarai, the younger sannyasins, younger, not according to age, younger according to the time of initiation. This king was old, and the king was a great king. But in the world of Buddha, those things don't count, neither the age, nor the money, nor the kingdom. He was the junior most, because just today he had taken sannyas. So he had to sleep in the porch, because there were no other place. The king could not sleep. It was difficult. And one can understand his difficulty. He had never slept in such a place. And you know Indian mosquitoes. And the king had never experienced the mosquitoes. And the ground was harsh. And the bhikkhus use no pillows, just their hands, their arms. He tossed and turned, but he could not go to sleep. In the middle of the night he thought, what I have done? This seems to be stupid. I should be sleeping in my palace. I had everything. This seems to be pointless. Tomorrow morning, the first thing I am going to do is to ask permission of the master that please excuse me. I cannot tolerate such unnecessary misery. I am going back to my palace. But in the middle of the night, Buddha came out. And he said, why wait for the morning? If you want to leave sannyas, leave right now. Why suffer the whole night? The king was amazed. He had not said it to anybody. There was nobody else. He was alone in the porch. He said, but how? You came to know. It was just a thought in me. Buddha said, if your thoughts disappear, you can start seeing others' thoughts. Because others' thoughts then are like things. It is because of your thoughts that you cannot see others' thoughts. You are so covered with your own thoughts, there is no space for others' thoughts. But you please go. The man said, now I cannot go. How can I leave such a master? Buddha said, but my suggestion is still this, that you will again think of leaving. You better leave. Only one thing I have to remind you. You had taken sannyas in your past life too. And the same difficulty. And you had renounced sannyas. Now the same difficulty has arisen. And it will arise again and again. You have not learned anything from your past life. As the Buddha was saying, the man suddenly felt a tremendous upsurge of the memories of the past life. He could see, he could remember that yes, this has happened. The whole situation was the same. The master was different. The sarai was different. The mosquitoes must have been different. But the king was the same person and the difficulty was the same. The king said, that's enough. Now I am not going to leave. I am going to stick. Now whatsoever happens, I have lived in the palaces many times and I have not gained anything. So I am not going to waste this life anymore. And he became enlightened one day. He persisted. A great perseverance must have been needed. He has come to the end of the way, Buddha says, over the river of his many lives, his many deaths. What you have been doing all your past lives, you have been just a driftwood at the mercy of the winds. No sense of direction. You have not achieved any integrity. Don't waste this life. Make something out of it. Create something out of it. Belly, a violin player from New York, finally found a job in a small restaurant orchestra. But on his first night of work, he played so terribly that the other musicians decided to fire him on the spot. Belly explained to them that he could really play much better, but he had been traveling for 2 months and had not been able to even touch his instrument. Tomorrow he would practice the whole day to get back in shape. The second day of work came and he sounded just as bad. Now he was really going to get fired, but he explained to the others that his wife had been nagging him the whole day, so that he had been unable to play even one note. Now this was something that the other musicians had much understanding for. So they gave him another chance. Belly said that tomorrow his wife would go to her mother's, so he could practice the whole day. But the third day, Belly sounded so bad that now even the waiters complained. That was it. he did get fired. Just as he was about to leave, one of the other musicians walked up to him and said, "Excuse me, but just out of curiosity, do you really make a living as a musician?" "Yes," replied Bailey. "Ah, but where do you work?" "Well, three nights here and three nights there," answered Bailey. "And that's how you have been doing for many lives, three nights here and three nights there, somehow earning your livelihood, just somehow trying to hold yourself together. But for what purpose? What have you achieved? What has been the gain?" "Certainly, you have passed time. But life is such a valuable phenomenon. It is not just to pass. It is an opportunity to grow, to be. Beyond the sorrow of hell, beyond the great joy of heaven, by virtue of his purity." The master transcends beyond the sorrow of hell, beyond the great joy of heaven. He is no more interested in pain and pleasure. Remember it, that if you seek pleasure, you are bound to suffer pain in the same amount. They always come in the same proportion. If you have so much of pleasure, you will have to suffer so much of pain. That is unavoidable. This is fundamental law of life. Life keeps a balance. The more you have pleasure, the more you will have to suffer pain. Hell and heaven are not geographical places, but psychological experiences. And they are not separate either. They are two sides of the same coin. If you have one, the other is there, just waiting for its right opportunity to assert. The man of understanding, the man of awareness, the man who has gone deep into meditation, into no mind, becomes aware of this whole phenomenon. He drops the whole coin. He is neither interested in hell nor interested in heaven. He is neither worried about hell nor desirous of heaven. Because he knows if you desire heaven, you will suffer in hell. This is something tremendously beautiful. Remember it. The so-called religious people are all desirous of heaven and the heavenly joys. They are not religious people at all. And these are the people who will suffer in heaven, in hell, wherever they are. It is not going to make much difference. Because if you desire one, the other follows it like a shadow. I have heard about a man in Hindu mythology. It is said then that in heaven there are kalp vrikshas. A kalp vriksha means a wish fulfilling tree. You sit underneath the tree, and whatsoever your wishes are, they are fulfilled immediately. You wish, and they are fulfilled. Instantly. Even instant coffee takes a little time. It is not so instant. But under a kalpa vraksha, no time gap between the desire and its fulfillment. You have not even desired and it is fulfilled. One man, a very religious man, reached heaven. He was tired, long journey from the earth to heaven. The first tree that he came across, he sat underneath the tree, tired. He was weary of the journey. And the tree was cool, shady. He rested underneath the tree. Suddenly he felt hungry. Immediately, beautiful food appears. He was so hungry, he did not even bother from where this food has appeared. He ate to his heart's content. Then he thought, if there was something to drink, immediately cold drink, maybe Coca-Cola. Appeared. He was very happy and he thought, now I would like to rest a little bit. But the ground is so uneven. If there was some bed somewhere available, suddenly out of nowhere, a beautiful bed. He had never seen in his life. He fell asleep. He was so tired that there was no question of becoming curious. But when he woke up, the sun was just coming down, was going to set. Now he was refreshed, well nourished. He became a little suspicious. What is the matter? I desired for food, if food appeared. I desired for drinks, and drinks appeared, and I desired for the bed, and the bed appeared. It seems this tree is haunted by ghosts. My God, are there ghosts? He thought, and suddenly ghosts appeared. So terrible, big monsters, just ready to jump upon him. He said, I'm finished. These people are not going to leave me. And of course, he was finished. They did not leave him. Because whatsoever you wish, they jumped upon him, tore him to pieces and ate him. Then and there, rah! The religious person, the so-called religious person, is not going to find peace even in heaven. Because his whole desire for heaven is basically wrong. The desire for pleasure is wrong because it contains the other side, pain. You cannot divide them. They are indivisibly one. This is one of the greatest contributions of Buddha, that he helped religious consciousness to go beyond heaven and hell. Otherwise, Judaism, Christianity, Mohammedanism, Hinduism, they are all confined to the world of heaven and hell. Their ultimate desire is how to attain to heavenly joys. Buddha says the ultimate is how to drop all desire, even that of heaven. Because only when all desire disappears, you are in a state of absolute freedom. He calls it nirvana. When the mind ceases, then you are bliss yourself. But it happens not because of desiring. It happens only when the state of desirelessness has been achieved. When desires have left you, in that space, bliss starts growing in you. He has come to the end of the way. Of course, there is no more to go anywhere. He has come home. All that he had to do, he has done. And now he is one. One with himself and one with the whole. You are many. You are a crowd. The Master is one. He is not a crowd. You are not one. You are many selves. So one moment you are one thing, another moment you are another thing. You go on changing. You just watch your mind. Every moment you go on changing. Because one self says, do this. Then another self comes and says, don't do this. Then another self comes and says, do something else. And you have many selves. You are multi-psychic. You don't have one mind, you have many minds. And you are being tortured by all these minds, pulled into different directions. The Master has no mind, hence he becomes one. With no desire, with no possessions, with no desire even for heaven, he is bound to become one. He becomes integrated. He is really the individual. Literally the individual. The word individual means one who is indivisible. You are not individuals. You are only persons. Personalities. And that too not one. You have many personalities, many faces, many masks you wear. The Master has no masks, no faces. He has only one face, his original face. He is simply natural. He has no mind, hence he is one. And the miracle happens when you are one with yourself. When you are one within yourself, you become one with the whole. And that is the ultimate stage. Call it nirvana. Call it kingdom of God. Call it God realization. Or whatsoever name you want to give it to it. It is nameless. But this has been the real goal of all the seekers of truth. Let this be your only goal. Prepare for it. I hope these beautiful sutras of Buddha will help you tremendously. Meditate over them. They are not philosophy. They are just statements of inner truths, statements of his experience, and they are also statements of my experience. Whatsoever I am saying here is not just a commentary on Buddha's sutras. Buddha's sutras are just an excuse. I am saying something which is my own experience too. And I would like that one day you can say this is your experience too. It is possible. You have all the potential of being a Buddha. Don't settle for anything less than that. Shake yourself and wake up. Enough for today.